Before we move on ever onwards and ever deeper, I hope very much that what we've been talking about all day is not confusing. Confusing in the sense that everyone has a practice. What how they perceive their practice and basic tenets and basic signposts and the way forward within their practice. Does anyone feel that what we've been talking about today in any way sort of clashes, or is it somehow completely different? Have I just got out of a spaceship, or can it be? I mean, the idea, which I hope is working, is that you can take what's been said today to broaden and deepen what you've actually got, what you're actually doing. I mean, it isn't something new in a sense. It's just filling out, if you like, what we're all doing. I don't believe that even if we had people from other traditions here, it would really impinge on whatever practice they're doing. Because I think these are sort of, the way it seems to me anyway, that these are very much the basic principles of Dharma practice and change. And they actually don't belong to any tradition. Whatever culture, whatever tradition we take on, these are very much to do with the clothing that we drape around the Dharma. Underneath the clothing is the living Dharma, but we shape it for our culture and for our particular tradition. But the basic fundamentals, I believe, are universal. So I hope what's been said so far is not in any way sort of contradictory or confusing. Is everyone okay, sort of? Mm-hmm. Good. So I think we can just carry on with what we were saying earlier, or pick up where we left off and spend most of... This is our last session today of discussion, so maybe we could exhaust this aspect of things in preparation for tomorrow, which is still basically the same, but maybe we'll introduce a few new sort of perspectives just to clarify. Because this is a very, what we've been talking today has been very, really very broad, I would say. Maybe tomorrow we can pick up on some aspects of containment or the difficulty of containment and highlight those and bring them out. But you were saying earlier,
we could go back to this.
We broke off at lunch.
That if, I mentioned how my awareness can be between my ears or around my chest. But I think you said that if you don't have that awareness in the lower part of your body, in the abdomen, then one doesn't have self-awareness really.
We have to be a bit careful about the word self.
Yeah.
I don't mean self in the sense of ego self. Mm. That living experience. The sense of self, the sense of ego, which I think maybe we could touch on a bit more tomorrow, is very much that part of us that exploits life and our experience of life, and then turns it into a very self-centered, self-motivated exercise that then causes the basic trouble that we're all experiencing. but if you find that your practice does tend to be pretty much in your head, which I think is what you're saying, with a little bit of body involved. It's perfectly natural and perfectly normal when we come to this practice that of course we have to orientate ourselves, we have to take on the concepts of Buddhism and the Dharma, and especially in this movement there's such a terrific emphasis on study, and the basic tenets of Dharma study is really about orientating ourselves into the Dharma. It's a turning away of the habitual experience of living our lives in our heads and actually turning that ship around, as it were, and facing it actually into the Dharma. And that's, I think, really is the essence of what study's about. It's not an end in itself, it's a means to an end. Because we can't think our way to nirvana. Although I think, well, I've heard of one or two people who seem to think you can do that, but I have my doubts somehow. That would be a very easy way out, wouldn't it? And I think that's the basic. I think that's the basic. The real function of the conceptual side of Buddhism is that it's actually a skillful means. It is not the end in itself. It's a means to an end. It's a new upaya that orientates, helps us to focus. But it carries a very great danger, and this is why we always have to be so careful about conceptual Buddhism, is that we take it very, very easily. We take it to be the real thing. And when we work a few things out with our minds, as we do, we read concepts, we haven't got a clue what they mean. And so we look into them and we read a few things and we talk a bit with people, and then slowly we get to some grasp of, for example, the Four Noble Truths, which is unknown in our culture. And because we get some sort of intellectual grasp of what that's all about, we think that's it. We think, I'm wise. I'm practicing correctly. I'm developing wisdom. And to get locked into that whole intellectual conceptual aspect of things, and it's incredibly powerful. It's incredibly alluring, and it's so convincing that most of us can't let that go. We can't. We say, yeah. Oh, yes, you're right. But then we just go straight back off again, back into the old habitual ways. And it is a very, very powerful attachment. Ultimately, it's a Mara. Even if it is pointing to great wisdom, it's still ultimately a Mara that you have to be very careful of. Once you allow yourself to get sucked in by that and convince yourself that this is it, you will miss the Dharma, you're missing the point, and you end up living your life, living your practice in your head. And this is what happens to so many people. And I believe, just going right back to the beginning when we first started, I think that the Dharma is in the totality of ourselves. It's Nama-rupa, it's in the totality. It isn't in just one aspect. I don't deny the intellectual side. We are human beings and we are intelligent and we do think for ourselves, and that's very necessary, even in the practice of Dharma. But it is a part of the whole. And it actually, in the scheme of things, actually ultimately doesn't have a great large percentage in the Dharmic scheme of things. It's very much more an intuitive, contemplative, nurturing practice. And as I was trying to point to earlier, that when you really do become alive and aware to yourself and really do start this nurturing process, you will find that it goes on a deeper and deeper level. And at least if it's only intellectual, to really try to nurture that coming back into your body while you're doing this practice. This again is not, you can't do this by an act of will, which is really what I'm trying to say to your question, that you know you could maybe understand what I say and accept what he said, but then you can't just do it by an act of will, because we've got so habitually caught in our heads, caught in our intellect, caught in this thing that seems to know all the answers, that we can't just let it go by an act of will. It becomes something very deeply ingrained, and it has a very, very strong self-identity. You see, that's ultimately the problem with it. It becomes my practice and my understanding and my wisdom. And that attachment to that, it's a very strong sense of self, and that becomes a very powerful attachment, and we can't let that go by an act of will. But through this nurturing of containment, which we, as I say, hopefully we discovered, it's much, much more in our form. And the more we look into it, the more we get to know it, we see that it's lower down. And the more that we can, as it were, change the habits of a lifetime. So it is they are habits of a lifetime. Even coming to the Dharma actually has not shifted those habits, because we still continue to live in our head the same as we've always done before even we came to the Dharma. And to learn to get familiar with that more and more and more. And this all takes place through this basic practice of containment, where we actually learn to live from our body. Live out of our body, not to live out of our heads. And the more that we can actually come back into our body, the more that we can be aware of our body in all situations, in all the four postures, in all the experiences, our daily experiences, whether they're mundane or whether they're very important to us, the more that we can actually see that we're living out of our body, the more we can begin to turn that ship around, so to speak, and actually stop doing this practice in our heads and trying to work it all out with a pencil, and actually come back into to focus into it, come into the body and go into the place where the Dharma really is. Because the Dharma is not in the head. Much as our intellect and our sense of self and ego would like to convince us this is where the Dharma is, actually it isn't there at all. And slowly this hopefully begins to dawn on us, and the more we stay with that and the more we look into that, the more we begin to understand ourselves, and truly begin to understand ourselves, and the more that should be, hopefully it should be inspirational, that actually maybe I should turn away from this trying to work it all out with a pencil all the time, trying to work it out with thought, and actually come and actually live life wholly, wholeheartedly, just experience life with very bright awareness. And in that cultivation, you'll become aware of yourself more and more, and that will have nothing to do with your intellect. That will be a part of you that's beyond your intellect. And in that nurturing, slowly you will come back in, and you will come back down. And certainly, when you sit down on your and to do your meditation, you will find yourself gravitating to that. You will find it easier in your meditation, obviously, because we're creating an environment for ourselves, a conducive environment. You will see more and more that this is where it's at. This is where the Dharma is. And the more you look, you'll see everything there. You'll see the Dharma, you'll see where samsara is, you'll see where the whole of life is actually emanating from, where it's actually coming from. And you become much more one with that, and you begin to understand it more deeply. And you'll see the world being created, and you'll see that which creates the world. And then in that very same place you'll see how the world can become uncreated and that which is beyond the world. And that truly is the inner journey. We're always talking about spiritual practice as being an inner journey. That, the inner journey doesn't take place in the head. The inner journey takes place within, deep within the inside of yourself. And all the questions and all the problems and everything will be resolved just by learning to get closer, learning to open up, learning to make friends, learning to commune with all of that. Things will become clearer. And in that clarity, things will change. But, as I keep saying, we have to nurture that. We can't do it by an act of will. You could all agree with me now. Hopefully, well, maybe you do, hopefully you do. You could all agree with me, say, yeah, great. Then put it into practice and see what it's like. You see how difficult it is. Because we've got ourselves into such a pickle. We've decided to live in our heads. We've decided that we can live life in our heads. We can work life out in our heads. And we can work everything out in our heads. And patently, we can't, can we? We wouldn't be here today. Clearly there's something wrong with that, isn't there? Somehow it's not working. Why isn't it working? It's because we're going in the wrong direction. We're looking in the wrong direction. And the whole of Dharma practice, the theory and the practice, is about focusing, turning the whole... The Buddha likened this Dharma practice to being carried along by a stream, by a river, by the current of a river. And then one day you decide to stop and turn around and go against the current. And that's how he likened Dharma training, Dharma practice. You can't turn around and go against the current just by an act of will. You've actually got to engage in it, and you've got to engage continually with it in order to go against the current, against the stream. You can't just turn around and float back upstream. You have to actually engage yourself. And that is the essence of the practice, and it is a commitment, because the moment you relax, the current just sweeps you back downstream again, doesn't it? So it's a consistent, steady commitment effort to go against all of that, to work with that, which is not to be carried away by it, not to be carried downstream by it. And it has to be learned, as I keep saying. This is not an act of will. It has to be learned. But it can be learned if you want to. If you want to learn it, you will. And you'll do it. But you'll see the forces. You'll see the forces that are saying to you, no, you're not going to do this. Sorry. You can think your way out. You can think your way to nirvana. That's a much better and much easier way. We'll carry on with that way, the way we've been doing all these years. But when you actually turn around and start to work with all of that that thinks that it can find its way out by thinking, then you'll see what you're dealing with. And that is in your body, and you learn to work with that. You see it and you learn to work with it as deeply as you possibly can go. Until in time, you will actually become much more integrated. You will actually know that, apparently, so I've been told, there are actually people in this business who don't even know they've got a body. So I've been told. And then people engage in all sorts of therapies just to get in touch with their body. Oh, I've got a body. They're so locked up in their minds that before they've even can really come to the Dharma, they've actually got to discover they've actually got a body as well. I mean, I find that quite difficult to relate to, but at the same time I can understand that and why is that? It's because we live in our heads. We spent all of our lives just trying to work everything out with our minds. And hopefully one day we wake up to the fact that actually that doesn't work. So maybe that's where we're all at. And the sort of thing that you're expressing is that There is that, just that habitual thing of trying to work it all out. Well, starting from tomorrow, or today, or this moment, learn to stay with that life force that's flowing, that's flowing out. Learn to stay with it, and learn to contain it, and learn to get closer and closer and commune with it, and become really alive and become really aware. And inside of all of that, you'll discover the truth. And that, nothing to do with this fellow, nothing to do with your ego, beyond all of that.
I'm just curious, Jonathan, what you mean by what your experience of mindfulness is, saying it's in your chest. What is it? What does mindfulness mean for you?
No, it's not even mindfulness, it's just my sense of awareness. Maybe it's a sense of gravity or something, I don't know. But
my impression is that there, although what you say, you know, but you can't just, we do quickly rise up into our heads very easily. It seems like there are things you can do in terms of just bringing your awareness lower in your body, and you were saying about, like, breathing down here and things,
yeah,
like that,
the breathing, yeah,
bring awareness,
yeah,
down,
yeah, know, yeah,
rather than just
sort
of,
sure,
because we habitually sort of stay up here,
yes, go. Yes, that is a good way of actually becoming aware that A, you have a body, and that actually you have there's a lower part of your body as well. It's like it's in sections, as it were. And this could come back to meditation. I don't know how people are taught how to meditate in a physical sense. No, I'm not talking about the theme, the subject, but actually in terms of posture and in terms of actually how we go about physically meditating. Hopefully, people are taught, or they learn, or they discover that when we breathe, when we're sitting, we actually breathe through our stomach much more than our chest. I mean, us people in the West were taught to breathe with our chest. People in the East are taught to breathe with their babies breathe through their stomach. Their stomach just rises and falls. That's the natural way of things. But in our culture, we're taught to breathe through our chest. Put your chest up, put your shoulders back. You know, sort of stiff upper lip, soldiery type thing. And consequently, that many of us actually breathe. When we breathe, we fill our lungs up from the top down by sticking our chest out like this. The lungs actually fill from the top down, and consequently, our lungs don't properly fill. Whereas if we learn to breathe through our stomach, if our lungs draw the air in because our diaphragm, our stomach, is actually going out, the vessel, the lungs, actually fill from the bottom up, which is the correct way of doing it. So if you watch a child, a baby, this is the natural way of doing things. I mean, apart from any other consideration, is actually the healthy way to breathe and fills the body with oxygen. But apart from that, what that does, again relating it to meditation, is it does help to ground you. It keeps you down here. You know, you've got your legs and your backside on the ground, and your weight, your form, should be down on the ground, that to give it that solidity. If the weight is up here, your awareness is up here, it becomes top heavy. It can, you know, it's unstable. So by even doing that, even just breathing properly, never mind what your meditational subject is, actually you become aware. Your awareness comes down here, and it's a part of mindfulness of breathing, or one of the ways of focusing on mindfulness of breathing is to be aware of your abdomen rising and falling. I don't think it's done in the movement, but that's one of the traditional ways of actually putting your attention down here while you breathe, and you can feel it. It's quite a crude sort of reflection. It's not a refined one. It's like the crudest is the counting. The second is to put your attention down here, and that's just by doing that is actually hopefully making you aware that you have a body, and that you're actually breathing down there. and to bring your attention down there. And not only meditating, but you can actually do it when you're walking around, when your mind is sort of fairly peaceful and you're not caught up with lots of very important things to think about. You can actually just bring your attention back to your breathing, just the rising and falling of your stomach. That's all helpful. That's all helping you to bring yourself back. You're aware that you have a body, for one thing, which seems to be quite an achievement. But secondly, you know, you're coming much down. You're coming much more into the base of your form, which is where the Dharma is. This is where the Dharma is.
If I start to think, just recollect your awareness, what happens is, this is what I become aware of.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it is for me, Jerry. So if I say, okay, just collect yourself, Dom, what I become aware of is it's here.
Right.
As opposed to my toe, my feet, or
right.
It's just this.
Well, that's a habit that you've got into.
Yeah.
Okay, now you can start to nurture a fresh habit. Put your attention on your breathing.
Yeah.
This actually shouldn't impinge whatsoever on whatever one of the mindfulness of breathing, or if you're doing your one of the aspects of metta.
Mm.
It should not impinge and alter it in any way. It should actually nurture it and help it. So don't think that by doing this, you know, you're not doing what you've been taught to do, you know, in terms of those practices. But it's very much helping you become aware. It may seem very simple, but actually, like I keep saying, we forget this. We rise up like a cork. We bring it down, and oh yeah, don't doubt. And then the cork rises up. And we look in our heads again. We've lost it. So we have to catch it and come back down again. Come back into that form until it becomes a habit. Until it comes to the point where, when you discover that you're not aware of this, oh, you know, this is wrong, and then you come back into your body rather than the other way around. It's habit making. It's all it is. It's just reconditioning, if you like. But it's a skillful reconditioning. It's a new pie. It's a means to an end. But it is a conditioning. A relearning.
How does this impact on the experience of metta? How you express or feel metta, in that there's a tendency to
not in the conceptual way, you mean?
Yes.
What you mean the method, the four or five stages. Yeah, well, but you can also bring it down into your body and do it, so it shouldn't actually impinge at all.
Mm.
It shouldn't. It shouldn't affect it at all.
There's two things. Now, first of all, actually, Kamala Shuddha mentions all of that, and particularly about breathing down here, when dealing, particularly when he's talking about dealing with sinking and drifting in access, in particular, when you're getting too much into your head. He talks about breathing, actually noticing your abdomen coming in and out.
Good.
To draw your attention back down.
That's right.
And actually, when I discovered that, it's quite powerful.
It is powerful stuff.
And even to use some lower part of your body as your focus for your breath, imagining your breath coming in and out through, say, your navel or something like that, to actually watch the breath coming in and out through there. The other thing too is Jerry says, I remember Randy saying something, gosh, one of the retreats in the last few months, and he was talking about the metta bhavana, that if you become, when you become distracted, to actually bring your awareness back to your entire body. To get that back, to really ground yourself back in your body, because that's where you're trying to get the metta from.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
But when you found yourself sort of wandered off, as you come back, before you come back to the actual metta itself, come back to the body first.
Mm.
Get yourself back, you know, really feel that quick scan, feel yourself right back in and then back into the practice.
That you're grounded, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to see some of the teaching. Yeah, I start them off for 1 week lying on their back and breathing in through the lower abdomen, breathing out through the heart. But what
like
I've found over the years is that.
Like him.
What I've found over the years is that
it's remarkable how many people can make progress doing partial breathing, doing bits of breathing. For example, somebody being stuck, somebody being actually just encapsulated in the, I used to do a critique of living just in this area here when doing methods of breathing, and yet for some people in their early days, or for other people much later on at a later stage, that degree of sheer concentration can actually be really, really dead useful. Another thing I found myself leaving aside, let's say years ago, it's that thing of, there is an understanding in some of the traditional texts that stage, are sequentially more difficult, four stages of counting breathing in the sati practice. But I keep coming across folk for whom that's not the case. You know, you can, stage four is the easiest, or stage two is the easiest, or stage three. So I'm a little bit more sort of soft on it now. It's a case of, like, fundamentally, I agree with you, and yet I just do want to put a wee flag up for this thing of just how far some folk can get some of the time doing some of this partial.
Yeah, really, what I think what you're talking about, where you're coming from, is that development of meditation itself and skillful ways of developing mindfulness and going on from that, which is fine, but this is a sort of a nurturing of the spirit of actually going on. I mean, I'm actually looking sort of beyond that, as it were, into an insightful way of beginning to see yourself.
The soul.
Well, remember, this is on tape. Yeah, because I tend to look at it in a sort of a holistic way, in terms of complete practice, as opposed to just I'm not actually picking out specific meditational techniques and doing that. Something I tend not to talk about. I just try to take it as a holistic, and of course the meditation is a part of the whole. But it's really a nurturing of that strange thing called the spirit. It's the spirit of the practice. I don't quite know how you define the spirit of the practice. It's not an intellectual thing. It's your engagement with it. It's your feeling, your love, your will to want to do it and to nurture it deeper and deeper. And there's all sorts of factors involved that I could sort of all put together and say, this is the spirit to nurture, this is the spirit of the Dharma, and this will take you deeper into the Dharma, that spirit, rather than sort of break it up and find a sort of a conceptual path. And, you know, cause to me the spirit is beyond concepts. It's a living commitment. And I think that's very, very important to nurture. And this is all part, to me, this is all part of that getting away from the head, that you can work it all out. Cut the Dharma up into compartments and, oh, let's work that one out. Oh, right, I understand. Now, well, let's go to this compartment and work this compartment out. Whereas the spirit is much more of an embracing of all of that and just sort of nurturing it on a deeper level and seeing it as much more of a holistic thing rather than a fragmented thing. And I think that's really where I'm coming from with all of this. I mean, I appreciate, and I know there's lots, I mean, this, like, just the whole phenomenon of meditation you could talk about for days, and all sorts of levels and all sorts of perfectly valid ways of, you know, expressing the whole exercise. But for me, I see it much more, as I say, as a developing of the spirit, of the totality, and of not seeing one posture as being more important than another, and to see them all come into one, and an equanimity that comes from that spirit, is that you don't pick and choose, you don't say, oh, this is a good time to practice, or this is good practice and that's bad practice, and get into that judgmental thing and that cutting up and fragmenting thing, but much more of a spirit of just embracing the whole lot and just learning to practice in all conditions, all emotions, all postures, whether you're sitting or whether you're in this here now, sitting around talking and listening, or having lunch, see it as the same. The Dharma, as I said earlier, the Dharma is in everything. And you know the Fourth Noble Truth. You know, we like to talk about the Eightfold Path, and you know, the path that we split up into eight convenient steps and then talk. But I don't... That's an upaya. That's a way of actually describing or expressing how we actually do this practice, because we have to learn it. But actually, the essence of the Fourth Noble Truth, the reality of the Fourth Noble Truth, is actually equanimity. When we are truly economist, when we are truly have that equanimity in all postures, in all situations, we find the middle way. And when we truly alight on the middle way, that middle way will take us through all postures, ultimately. Not just we practice the middle way when we're on the cushion, or when we're in some situation that we decide that, you know, we want to engage in. But when that middle way is like a thread that runs through our entire lives, when that thread is actually nurtured and it's consistent through all postures and all situations, this is the peak of practice. You can't do any more. This is it. This is the ultimate. And when you abide in that state and you stay in that state, nurture that state and stay in that state, then the Dharma will open up. Then that's when you would enter the stream. And that's the perfection of the Fourth Noble Truth. So for me, I see that rather than just, as it were, put my eggs in one basket, focus on one particular aspect of this, I'd much rather stand back and see it as a totality. Because ultimately, if there is that desire, or I don't know what you can call it, that wish, that hope, that ultimately we do enter the stream, that equanimity, that middle way, there's no compromise on this. That middle way has to be ever present in all situations. And when it's truly ever present, when it's truly there, this is when the Dharma will truly reveal itself through what we call stream entry. And that's what we're working towards. So if we focus that on that in the beginning, whatever we do is always going to be taking us down to that final step, final stage. And I think to embrace all of those factors, it's really a nurturing of the spirit towards everything, and an embracing of all of life, and of not discriminating, and of not picking and choosing. And the more we go down that road, the more we get out of our discriminating mind, and the more we actually come into our body, and the deeper that we go into ourselves, we will find that equanimity is actually waiting there for us. That middle way is there waiting for us. We don't make the middle way. We don't create it. We discover it.
Go back to the sense I get of bringing yourself to your body is it's almost like, you know, geographical point in space. So the reality seems to be, or for me anyway, it seems like it's for most people, you know, that geographically, you know, your spirit, I should almost say, is up here. So that being the case, then, or we have our awareness of it up here. Is it that being the case, then it's a wise move to keep orientating it down here? I'm just trying to put this in my own words to see whether I'm not on the wrong track.
What do you think? Your spirit's in your head?
No, I think that's my bad use of words.
Your internal
space, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm locating. I didn't mean it like that. I'm saying two things. One, it's like I get the sense, or what I feel of when things are going right, if I'm listening to what you're saying, is you actually locate your awareness, or keep bringing your awareness back to this area in space.
Yes.
Yeah. And awareness in this sense means your whole what you would regard as the spirit of your practice.
Yeah.
So that's what you're doing, and because we're up here so much, in a sense, that's why it's the most important thing to do, because if we're not doing that, then all the other stuff is on the surface,
yeah,
or it's in the wrong place. Right. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a coming home. It's coming into the into the soul, into the heart, if you like.
Strong teeth.
Whoops. You see how easily led I am.
It feels like that's the way.
Yeah, actually, you know, a part of this path of discovery and a part of the wonder of it all, you know, we're convinced that we actually live in our heads, and we are in our heads, and I exist in my head. But actually, when you really, really go into that, you really begin to start to doubt that, actually. Do I actually really live in this brain, in this head? Is this the real me? Is this really me? It's a very interesting journey, discovery. And you may begin to even doubt that you live in your head, ultimately. It's spooky to that doesn't like the idea of that, but actually there's something beyond that, actually, which is far more wonderful, far more expansive and wonderful, actually, when you actually begin to discover that, it's not spooky at all, actually. It can have its fear elements with it, but when you discover that, I think you begin to discover, possibly for the first time in your life, that you spent your entire life in jail, and for the first time you actually get a taste of freedom. Somehow the doors swung open, and you at least you get to look outside, even if you don't get to step outside. And then you really begin to see how incredibly ensnared and trapped we are, and how we're just bound by something that's so deceiving, that's so clever, but actually is pathetic, actually. Without wishing to sort of develop sort of negativity towards yourself, but that thing that thinks it's so clever and that's so alive and knows everything, and the thing that we attach to so very, very powerfully, actually, in the scheme of things, is pathetic. So to make that discovery can be really quite inspiring, quite liberating, quite inspiring, quite uplifting, energizing. And this is what I think one of the things that you discover the more that, and you really do begin to doubt this whole assumption, I am here, I am living up here, and this is my body down here. And that duality, that's like the initial duality, me and my body, that's where the whole dualistic world starts, and then you project it out. I am here, Donald's over there, this space, I am here, I am this person here, I am this separate being from the world. This is where loneliness comes from. This is where fear comes from, that very, very, very basic a notion that we create for ourselves, a separation. And that separation, the very first separation that we create, is me and my body. And so this whole practice, this whole process, is like going right the way back to the beginning, coming right back before that first thought arises. And when we get back there, then we are free. And that's, to me, is the journey. And it's, you know, well, maybe we can talk about.
It's, in a way, is there a sense that the ego is playing a game with us? It's keeping us in our heads.
Are you kidding?
because if we, it doesn't want to change, and it knows that if we do, in some ways, if we can really engage with here, the consequences of that are going to be enormous changes, and it's going, you know, it's which it's going to be involved in totally, at our whole total being. So it keeps us in this intellectual playground, where we go away, spend our lives up here, where we're actually not having much of an effect. So it keeps us, there, in a way.
Whatever thoughts, habits that we have, whatever our attachments are, whatever they may be, they're always grounded in the sense of self. This is where the self-identity comes. This is my view. This is my desire. This is my dislike. There is this self. This self-view is there, and that's the attachment. This is me. I'm not changing. Any thought of change, any thought of giving that up, is actually what you actually doing. You're actually giving yourself up. You're actually dying, actually, in a very real sense. I mean, in a dharmic sense, not in a physical sense. And, of course, the self doesn't want to do that. The self always wants power, always wants to be in control. And it will find, and it's the most clever. It can be the crudest, most horrible thing, but it can also be the most incredibly subtle. And it will do anything it can in order to retain itself. So whatever comes up, even your dharmic understanding, even your dharmic, genuine dharma that arises, it immediately identifies, this is my understanding. I am wise. I am enlightened. I am this. I am that. That then becomes its possession. The self then identifies, even with dharmic understanding, never mind stupid things, but even with, you know, deep dharma can become stupid, can become, you know, dragged into the world by this sense of me. And that manifests right across the board, and this is actually what we're working against. We're actually, what we're doing with containment, and this is what I was hoping to touch on tomorrow, what we're actually doing with containment is that we're actually transforming ourselves, and that self actually, in a very real sense, is actually dying. And it doesn't die. It doesn't die lying down. It will find any way, from the most crudest, most obvious ways of fighting to the most subtle, so subtle that I don't care who you are, you won't pick it. It is so clever, and it's got a whole spectrum, a whole raft of ways of making sure that it stays, that everything becomes me and mine. And the whole dharmic process, this whole containing, what we're actually doing there is that we're giving that self up. And this is why we can't do it. This is why we have such incredible difficulty. And how in that process of actually willingly engaging in that giving of ourselves up, it can bring up the most negative, the most darkest, the most fearful of forces that will say, look, I'm sorry, mate, you're not doing this. You know, I'm the boss, you're not. I don't mind playing around with you. Let's get into a few little head games. Let's, you know, let's pretend we're wise and, you know, and all of that. That's great. The self likes that because it's taken hold of all of that stuff. And the self doesn't mind how it manifests itself as long as it can actually be. And this is, if you like, if you want to look at it in that way, this is like the battlefield. But it's not a battle. But this is where the dharmic environment is created, where this sense of self, this thing that will not give itself up without a fight, this is what we're learning to work with. And this is the whole, the very, very heart of the practice. And it is so clever and it is so subtle. I don't care who you are, you'll never pick it. Hence we follow teachings, hence we come into Sangha, where we can keep refreshing and checking ourselves, because we can convince ourselves, I don't need Sangha, I understand the Dharma, I know how to practice, go off on our own, I can do my meditation, all of this stuff. Convince yourself that you've got it all sussed out, and actually it's quite very, very easy, and I don't need I don't need a teacher, I don't need sangha, I don't need people telling me what to do or challenging me in any way. This is ego. And this is the great value of situations like this. This is the great profundity of sangha, where we come together in these situations thinking that we're the big I am, we got it all sussed out, and then we bring up something and somebody challenges it. And then, you know, oh my God, I thought I got it all worked out, and I'm just, you know, it's just all taken away from us. And that's the way, this is the polishing process. I mean, this is what happens, it happens to all of us. And it's the polishing process of just bringing our understanding and then somebody coming along and taking it away, or hopefully we take it away, we drop it, we let it go. And it's a polishing, it's not an achieving thing that we actually get this thing like this. It's a nurturing of something and then a letting go of it and then a moving on. And in that letting go, you're letting go of that attachment, that self that is incredibly crude and stupid, but also can actually be very, very clever. Very, very clever.
Do you find the Western Buddhist order of Sangha challenging you?
Many ways. Of course. I suppose I could say in a way that I have basically been on my own for certainly sort of, what should we say, 18 years, since early 80s, although I've been around Sangha a bit, but I've not really engaged because I've never felt that it's the right Sangha for my practice. And it's very, very easy to, you know, me in my position, I can say, well, this is how you practice the Dharma, because that's how it's worked for me. Therefore, if it's worked for me, it can work for everybody, which it can in one sense. But also, there are subtle sort of shady parts of that, where people have actually practice it in a very, very slightly different way, although actually fundamentally it isn't different, but it can seem that way. And that can be a challenge to me, because I can say, well, this is the way to do it, and then they say, well, hang on a minute, there's also this way too, and I have to check that with myself. Not that there's necessarily anything wrong with the way that I do the practice, but the fact that there is actually, you know, slightly different ways of doing it, going about it. And coming into Sangha, coming in, is always a challenge. The most difficult thing in the world is to live with yourself, but close on the heels to that is living with other people. And that's always a challenge, isn't it, when you live with people, when you're associating with people. It's continual, isn't it?
But then, it's not that bad. You've not done it for years, have you? You've not done it for years, have you?
No, you missed a bit that we were talking of what challenge I may feel within the coming to the movement. So, what time are we sitting again? 20 past. Oh, it's 4. I thought it was 4:15. Okay. Good. Wonderful how we're disciplined, keeping to the schedule. Wonderful, isn't it?
First time I've ever seen that happen.
Well,
speak
for yourself.
Well, in Ireland, anyway.
We'll replicate it tomorrow.
Where have you been, Mark?
So, if we have our cup of tea, and then we can do our final sit together. So. I think it's quite a seems to be quite a nice it seems to have petered out, which is quite good.
And the language